Welcome to the Finance Administration Operations Committee meeting of March 19th. You please take the roll.
Committee Chair Peterson.
Here.
Director Garcia. Director Gonzalez.
Here.
Chair Wolf.
She's
Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Chair Wolf is on her way, a little delayed with the weather. Is there any public comment? I wasn't aware of any public comment today. Approval of the minutes of the Finance Administration Operations Committee meeting held on February 19th. Any comments or corrections or changes? There being none, do I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second, I'll second it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Moves the full board. Executive Director, Christy LaFleur.
Oh, thank you. Well, today it's that time again. Our quarterly financial review is upon us, and in order to make sure that we get the most out of this report, we've asked Mike Kelch to deliver the presentation today and talk through the quarterly results from the fourth quarter of last year. Since we went through an annual budgeting process, frankly, there's a lot of repeat information here, and frankly, you've probably seen most of this before. But we are, required and want to do this. It's our fiduciary responsibility, of course, to share this information. And we're going to close out the year with this quarterly report. Right after this, we're going to go through a debt management update presentation, and I'll just maybe do a little preamble before we get started on that. But Mike, if you want to go ahead with the 2013 year-end/fourth-quarter report.
Thank you, Christy. Good morning, directors.
Morning. Good morning.
As Christy mentioned, much of this material, I believe, you're probably familiar with. We've been discussing the status of the 2013 budget throughout the year and updated it at the time of the 2014 budget preparation. But with respect to the final results, and these are preliminary and unaudited, although we don't expect them to change significantly. Between now and the time the audit is completed. Revenue actually exceeded $1 billion for the first time in the tollway's history. In 2013, it was approximately $12 million greater than what we had estimated back in October. It was primarily due to toll revenue and evasion recovery being higher than projected for the year, particularly during the fourth quarter. Commercial vehicle traffic, in particular, was strong in the fourth quarter of this past calendar year. Passenger vehicle traffic, which was down in the first quarter of the year, actually down relative to estimates in the first quarter of 2013, rebounded nicely throughout the year and did well in the fourth quarter as well, but it was the commercial vehicle traffic, I think, that stood out. Maintenance and operations, maintenance and operations spending was $5.9 million less than we budgeted, which is about 2% less than the budget. Primarily, it is due to vacant positions and savings from lower personnel numbers than what we had budgeted, as well as related costs, group health insurance. But we also had some savings in contractual services in the areas of engineering, IT, and some maintenance contracts with respect to our toll collection. On the capital program, and Kathy will speak to this a little more later, all the major deliverables were achieved this year, but we did have some savings relative to what we had planned. I shouldn't say savings. We did have some reduced costs in 2013 relative to what we had planned in October, primarily timing and scheduling issues. Timing and scheduling, particularly land acquisition at O'Hare, and we'll speak to that as well. Just a reminder, we did revise revenue estimates up slightly in October when we presented the tentative 2014 budget. We increased them $12 million, about $10 million in total in evasion recovery and $2 million in miscellaneous and concessions. We allocated that revenue to the three areas: maintenance and operations, debt service, and deposits to renewal, replacement, and improvement. Those are our capital accounts. One thing of note here, we did allocate less to debt service in 2013 than what we had projected at the start of the year. And that's due to a couple of factors: slightly lower interest rates than we assumed. We only issued $500 million as opposed to $1 billion we had planned for. And we had a refunding midway through the year as well. So specifically, you can see a little bit more of the breakout on the revenues. Again, 10.4 million on total revenue and evasion recovery, and then 1.5 million on miscellaneous is where we saw the increases relative to budget.
Like the total evasion recovery was 10 million, you said 10.3 million for the year, for the quarter.
Total revenue and evasion recovery was higher, $10.4 million. Evasion recovery alone was about $4 million of that variance.
$4 million variance for the year.
For the year relative to the revised estimate that we did in October.
Okay.
On the operating side, you can see the primary variances are the payroll and related costs, $4.6 million. We spoke to that. Contractual services, $3.4 million, again, in the area of engineering and IT consulting, as well as some business service contracts, which included maintenance on toll collection equipment and, quite frankly, credit card fees, too, were a little less than budgeted. Materials and operating supplies, surprisingly, was down in 2013, even though the winter, the December weather was difficult this year. A lot of snow events starting in mid-December. We had a relatively mild spring winter at the start of 2013, so it didn't cost as much for the tollway to restock our salt and other winter materials in 2013 than we had expected when we prepared that budget. We did have an increase in all other insurance, that is workers' compensation, deposits to the Workers' Compensation Reserve Fund. Each year we have an actuary come in and assess not only the current year, but past fiscal years in terms of what they believe we should put into the claim reserve to accommodate those claims. This year we had a number of settlements, and actually back in 2012, and a number of changes to claim reserves that prompted the actuary to suggest that we put another $3 million or so into the claim reserve for past years. So that's why that increased.
One of the things that I think we're looking at and would like to get your feedback on is, you know, the timing of these actuarial assessments is such that we don't have them when we produce our budgets for the upcoming year, so we have to make these revisions. And we're, I think, looking at my kind of twofold, you know, speaking to the actuaries about, you know, the averages they use, because we prefer, of course, not to see big fluctuations, and we want to always be conservative, but also thinking about the timing of when we get their reviews, so maybe we can use them in the budgeting process instead of kind of getting things mid-year and then having to make adjustments. And is that something that you think would be appropriate for us, those two things to explore? I just want to make sure everybody, I don't know how you do it in your own organizations, yeah, if you're familiar.
Well, you know, one thing that I've seen is that, like, when we put the 2013 budget together, and forgive me because I can't really remember the difference between 2013 and 2012, but I remember we were going up because we were looking at maybe filling some bunch of engineer positions, and we didn't do it, and 2013 seemed like the actual was less than the budget in certain categories. But yeah, when we put the 2014 budget, we're using 2013 budget numbers, and we're saying, okay, we're going to increase our maintenance and operations from the 2013 budget by 3%. Well, if the actual is already coming in $5.9 billion below, moving forward, can we start looking at a budget versus an actual versus where we were last year actual? So that could kind of give us a better idea of putting that budget together for the next year, because we could I think if you're just using budget versus next year's budget, and the actual is always a lot different, it's the actual that should be, the big source in producing that next year's budget, and not the budget from the previous year.
Yeah, so that's a different point. And I will say that as far as hiring goes, hiring has picked up, and you can see here we're only 3%. So, and it, you know, we don't want to underestimate it, but you know, it's a fairly small percentage difference. But you know, clearly, I think that there are ways for us to be, maybe there are opportunities for us to be more precise, and we can look at that when we prepare next year's budget and see, you know, if we should be. We do try to take the actuals, I think, into account, but we also want to give ourselves flexibility. For hiring to pick up, which we've, I think, successfully streamlined the hiring process and gotten some additional hires on, which we're excited about. But also, you know, leaving room for things like these winter conditions that we've seen. You know, this was an unprecedented winter with a lot of extra work and overtime, frankly, from some of our employees. So we do like to try to leave some flexibility. But maybe when we go through the budgeting process this, you know, this fall, as we look at 2015,
right.
You know, we'll go back and take a closer look at those actuals and see if we can, you know, further reduce or kind of account for different growth patterns in some of these lines where we just historically see underspending.
Okay.
But what about, just getting back to the other question, does anyone take any issue with us doing that on the workers' comp? Talking to the actuaries about those two adjustments, I can't imagine.
We'll recommend doing that, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a particularly opportune time to look at this. We are planning to go out with a request for proposal for the actuarial services.
Okay.
So, we'll look at whether it makes sense to adjust the claim year. We'll also, report back our review of why we think the actuarial estimates changed over the last couple of years, and including what role the actuary may have played, plus what other circumstances outside of their control resulted in those changes the last couple of years. Because I think that's important for all of us to understand. With respect to the capital program, I'd like Kathy to.
Good morning.
Morning.
So as Mike mentioned earlier, the capital program expenditures were less than our revised estimate. Mainly due to timing of right-of-way, scheduling changes, and project cost savings. If you look at this slide, you can see that the Move Illinois CRP variance was $83.1 million. Add other capital projects to that, $4.1 million, and the total capital program was variances $87.2 million. We also had intergovernmental agreement reimbursements of $11.8 million, giving us a total variance of $99 million for the capital program. So this page summarizes the variance. Most of the variance can be attributed to timing of right-of-way acquisitions, $49.7 million. We had scheduling changes of $30.6 million and some project cost savings of $2.8 million for this year compared to our revised estimate. Other capital projects variance $4.1 million, again, and that gets us to our total capital variance of $87.2 million.
These are governmental agreement reimbursements and other adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically. Well, there was no estimate for this. Will we have estimates going forward?
No, we don't typically budget for intergovernmental agreements.
Okay. Reimbursements over a certain period of time?
Yeah. We typically just show what the agreement, amount that's been received is compared to. We don't budget initially for that.
Okay.
So that's why you see the variances, but actually the total.
have, and that we started that practice as a result of not having good certainty with respect to the timing of some of the reimbursements from some of the local agreements. So we're able to recognize that those amounts when they come in. It provides some resources for the capital program once we receive them, but we don't plan on them being received in a specific year until after we actually receive the money.
Okay. Any questions on that?
Go ahead.
So just in summary, as Mike mentioned, revenues $11.8 million above target, mainly due to increased traffic and evasion recovery revenue. Our maintenance and operation expenditures were $5.9 million below budget due to a number of vacancies and lower contractual services and materials and other items. Debt service transfers, $21.9 million less than we originally budgeted. And again, the capital program, $87 million below our revised estimate. You should note that with Move Illinois program, all of the key deliverables for 2013 were achieved. The reduced expenditures were a result of schedule modification and bid savings. And if you look at what we spent over 2012, we spent nearly two times on the capital program in 2013 than we did in 2012. And then there are some other additional slides in the appendix that goes into more detail with the key variance on the capital program and other comparisons to other years. Thank you.
The debt service transfer is $21 million less than budget. What specifically do you attribute that to? Is there a couple of things that played into that? On the debt service side?
Refunding of the bonds? We had initially budgeted for $1 billion of new money to be issued.
Okay.
We issued $500 million. The interest rates were actually a little bit less than what we had budgeted. But primarily it was two things that were refundings that we did in 2013. And the biggest piece, though, was the timing of the new money.
The new money release.
Yeah.
And is that... excuse me for being late, and I'm not sure to ask you this when we talked about this before. Is that permanent savings or is that a timing issue?
It's
both, right? Because it's refinancing the interest rate.
Because we save it permanently for this year. Ultimately, at some point, years off into the future, we'll have more.
Well, we received lower interest rates, yes, then those would be permanent.
Yeah.
But you know, clearly, when we'll issue those new bonds at some point, right, this year.
Yeah.
So those are permanent.
I was just trying to clarify.
Oh, and when we're talking about in capital, the timing of the right of way of acquisition and the scheduling changes, are those savings moved over? Or is that something we're going to incur in 2014 because of the changes, or?
It is a timing issue.
Yes. So that $80 million would then probably show up in 2014?
Yes.
With the exception of the savings, right? So
yes.
We're reflecting 2.8, but really we had about, from the original budget, we had about $81 million of savings.
Right.
So those, would be real savings that I suppose there would be some discussion about whether those go, where those go, but they can certainly be used for additional projects with our roads or maintenance or something else for the maintenance of our infrastructure.
Although, wouldn't you think as long as we have the Move Illinois program going, we want to make sure that we have, you probably already had it built in, but enough of a cushion that if there were more expensive things down the line that we hadn't anticipated, we would have that available.
Yeah, with a 15-year program, I think we do have to assume that, in the out years, things could happen that we can't anticipate, whether it's interest rate changes or, increased costs for some, supply material type item, steel skyrockets, that would drive up our costs.
But the savings we're talking is only 2.8 million. Or
compared to the revised budget.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So we did budget adequately for our right-of-way and even utility expenses. We didn't necessarily need that money, but we wanted to make sure we had the funds available. You know, if we were able to move forward with the those transactions, they are going to happen. You know, primarily the right of way will happen probably this year. I mean, I appreciate your comment, Chair and Director, because you know, we're in the first part of the program and things are good. We're delivering everything we've promised so far, and we're, you know, still coming in below our projections, but it's a long program and we want to make sure we're able to deliver all of it.
Thank you. Thanks. Any other questions? Do you want to go forward with the next one?
Yeah, Christy, maybe.
Oh, sure. So the next presentation, what we wanted to do was a little update on debt management. So both what we saw last year, so a little bit of history, you know, what we're planning for this year, but also at the end, we'd just like to frame a future discussion and get some feedback from you, what information you're going to need from us in order to have a discussion next month about what we see as some kind of key kind of policy level decisions when it comes to, you know, our debt management and investment management plans here at the tollway. So Mike, if you want to start off, and when we get to this, particularly ask questions of course whenever you'd like, but particularly at this last slide, what we're really looking for is feedback from all of you about information you're going to need to be able to you know, help guide us in some of these policy decisions.
So what we want to cover today are some of the issues that we have dealt with during 2013 and some of the issues that we will be looking forward to addressing in 2014. I'm going to speak a little bit to the results of the refundings that were authorized and executed in the past 12 months. I'm going to speak to the replacement of or the renewal of liquidity facilities. Remember, those are the bank agreements that we have that support our variable rate bonds. In the event that those bonds are put back to the tollway, we have a third party that can fund that acquisition or fund that purchase. We want to speak a little bit to the new money issuance that's coming up in April. And then, as Christy mentioned, some upcoming issues, some policy issues that we want to give you a preview on and get some thoughts in terms of how we might proceed with that discussion. During August of 2013 and February of 2014, we were able to effect two refundings for economic savings. Those refundings have totaled $665 million approximately of bonds that were refunded at a present value savings of $57.3 million. That was a quite a positive result. We did have some market issues. If you recall, during the summer of late spring, summer, and early fall months of 2013, that caused us to split this refunding into a couple of different series. We were able to wait until early 14 to execute the largest portion of the refunding, and it did work out rather well. A reminder that $57 million is an amount that we will save over the life of the refunded bonds. So it's not funds that are immediately available to the tollway, but will be saved during that period.
Remind us what the life of these bonds is.
These are until 2024, Bill?
2023, actually.
2023.
Thanks.
We do have some remaining refunding authorizations. The bonds that we refunded were Series 2005 bonds. There's some amount left to refund for 2005, about $76 million. It's likely that most of that will not be refunded because it's a very short period between the call date and the maturity date. In fact, we have ideas about how we might handle that in a year or so. Rather than actually issue bonds to refund it, we may be looking for the board to provide authorization to just make an early payment, cash payment, to buy those out. And we'll be talking about that over the next 12 to 18 months. There's also $292 million of Series 2006A bonds that we will continue to monitor, that we could refund, and we have enough authorization to accommodate that refunding should the market present an opportunity to do so. We also have authorization, which we've had for several years now, to restructure or refund the synthetic fixed rate bonds. Fortunately, as you'll see from the next slide, we've been able to replace the underlying liquidity for those variable rate bonds at favorable rates, and with a nice diverse portfolio of banks. But there are certain risks associated with the synthetic fixed rate structure that if the cost of doing that restructuring or refunding is small enough, we would make a recommendation to proceed with refunding those or refinancing.
Mike, what do you see as the timing on the 2006A, the $292
million? The latest evaluation is that the market the market doesn't warrant proceeding with those, but it's getting close on some of them. So it's possible that after we execute the April issue, that if the market holds up as it is right now, we could be seeking approval to move forward with that. So I would say earliest would be probably a May or June time frame. Bill, do you agree with that?
Yeah, that similar to 05, every passing month reduces the negative arbitrage, so if rates hold, it helps to wait, but once you achieve a certain level, you want to pull the trigger in summer or fall. Right. We'll have good numbers.
There were actually a couple of the maturities for 2006 we looked at pretty closely in February, but we just thought that waiting would provide us an opportunity to do better on those. Again, because as Bill mentioned, we still have that big difference between what we can borrow it and what we can reinvest.
And we look at them with a financial advisor. Chair Peterson and you all need to talk about that. And Christy.
Bill, been very busy the last few months. We have $1.3 billion of variable rate bonds that are swapped to fixed, and all of that debt have underlying credit facilities to support those issues. And there are, I think, 10 agreements, Bill?
Yes.
We have 10 liquidity agreements that periodically need to be renewed or replaced. And through the efforts of many, particularly Bill, we've been able to execute a replacement or renewal of all of those facilities. You can see the expiration dates are now from February of 2016 through March, I believe, of 2017. We were able to continue with a very nice diversified portfolio of providers and significantly reduce the costs from an average of 68 basis points to 44 basis points, which is about a $3 million annual savings on those liquidity agreements.
Good job.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay. And are any of these new?
Yes, Mizuho and RBC.
And Bank of America.
Was Mizuho the bank that we had some issues with?
One of the three rating agencies downgraded the bond rating from AA plus to AA minus because their rating on the Zuho is A minus, and that brings brings the bond rating down. The former bank was rated, the bank that was replacing was rated AA minus. Now in the marketplace, AA minus on a weekly floater where the bondholder has the option to tender on 7 days notice, and certainly has no impact in today's market, and most markets would not be expected to.
And in fact, the short-term rating is the more important rating than the long-term rating. And they have one of the highest, no, they have one of the highest short-term ratings, but certainly
that's right.
A short-term rating similar to the other banks.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about what the, I read this article, but I think it would be useful to talk a little bit about what were the reservations of bonds for reflected in that rating?
Fitch all of the rating agencies apply a dual analysis when they rate these bonds. So they take into consideration both the bank and the tollway in assessing the long-term rating, which is why you can have a bank that's rated A plus and the tollway that's rated AA minus and get a bond rating of AAA by S&P. All of our subsidiaries are rated AAA by S&P, and all of them are rated AA1 by Moody's. But with Mizuho, and they're all rated AA plus by Fitch, but with Mizuho, because their long-term rating is getting a little bit lower at AA minus, they bypass the dual analysis and instead go to an approach of the higher of the two ratings, the higher of the always AA minus rating and Mizuho's A minus rating, and that produces the bond rating of double A minus for that subsidies.
Maybe I didn't ask a question right. What are the reservations about Mizuho that causes them to be rated at what level they're in?
Reservations about Mizuho.
Mizuho's bank rating itself as opposed to the rating on the bonds.
Fitch's analysis of Mizuho showed a capital position that was further analysis a little bit weaker than what they thought was appropriate for a higher rating category. So it was capital, bank capital related. Now Moody's and Standard & Poor's both rate Mizuho at the equivalent of A plus. So they're, you know, not seeing the same issues. Standard & Poor's does have a negative outlook. It's not credit watch negative, but it's a negative outlook.
And our financial advisors comfortable with Mizuho?
Very comfortable.
This was temporary with Mizuho. They were really holding this for a short period of time. Is that correct? Holding? No. Was it a long-term play?
Yes. There are two-year facilities.
It was a two-year facility. Okay. Yeah. Right.
Now, they can be terminated at any time without the
There are other aspects of the new Mizuho agreement that are really favorable relative to some of the other bank agreements as well, including the termination provision at no cost, including their fee, including some of the events of default types of provisions that they had that are more favorable to the tollway than some of the other bank agreements. We had a number of discussions. It's a labor-intensive process for the lawyers to go through these agreements. We try to standardize them as much as possible, but the banks, of course, have different counsel and different ideas of what they need in the agreement. So overall, we thought the Mizuho agreement was a good agreement for us.
Thank you.
We do have a new money issue coming in April. We plan about a $450 million sale in April. That would be half of our total needs for 2014. We could go up to $500 million. That's the remaining authorization we have from the board. The current estimated 25-year bond rate we have here, 4.7%. Actually, this is a conservative reflection of the market. We could do as well right now as 4.5% on 25-year bonds. So relative to our assumption, about 5% debt in 2014 and 5.5% thereafter, we're hitting the market at a good time. We expect it print the official statement in the week of April 7th, and price in the week of April 14th or the 21st. So upcoming in 2014, we have a number of first, I guess, and likely in May, and possibly in June, we have a number of different policies and procedures that have been helping, that the board has had input in the past that has helped us to manage and monitor and provide guidance on our debt management program. One of them is our investment policy. The second one is our debt management guidelines. And we've also entered into an agreement to have a post-issuance compliance program, in which we have specific post-issuance procedures that we need to follow, which helps us in case there's ever a question with our tax compliance, to the extent that we have put this program in place and can evidence that we followed that program, it will be a favorable reflection on the tollway if there's ever a question about whether or not we've complied with all the federal tax regulations. Now, we wanted to give you a little bit of a preview today, as Christy mentioned, of some of the issues in the areas of the investment policy and the debt management guidelines that we may want to discuss and get your input on some of those issues. Bill has a list he'd like to hand out of some of those items.
When was the last time you made any changes to these three policies, or the investment policy to start with?
I think it was 2 years ago. Is that true? 2 years ago.
What was that change when we did it 2 years ago?
We looked at the target for the percentage of bonds or debt that the OE has that should be variable rate. And we looked at some of the authorized investments. What do you remember? What else we?
The consistency of the investment options.
We looked at that 2 years ago as well.
Yes, we did, and we inserted some language, caveating certain investment choices, because at the time they may be allowable under one of the three parts of our investment policy, which those three being our indenture, the investment policy itself, and the Public Funds Investment Act, but they may not be authorized under all three, so we have to meet all three.
Another issue we looked at, you remember, Chair, was the role of underwriters and financial advisors, and under what circumstances we would use a firm as an underwriter if they had previously served as a financial advisor. That's an issue that, given the new rules being proposed with respect to municipal advisors, that we would want to revisit as a part of this discussion. We can get you materials on that before next month's meeting as well.
That was part of the Dodd-Frank bill. Dodd-Frank had that municipal advisor piece.
It came out of that.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Okay.
It came out of that. It wasn't specifically part of the Dodd-Frank rules.
So for sure, one piece that we need, since I don't remember any of this, is a track change of what we did 2 years ago.
Okay.
Just for study.
But to just give you a little bit of a preview, so we wrote down a few of the items that, many of them are kind of technical in nature, but they're important to receive your views and input on. But one of the things that we know is that our investment returns have been very low, and we've always prioritized safety, and I think we want to continue to prioritize safety. But the factors of safety, liquidity, and investment return, we may want a little bit more of a discussion about how willing or how favorable we might feel about modifying our investment portfolio in terms of taking a little bit more risk of market risk in terms of going out longer on our investment portfolio. As Bill mentioned earlier, there's some inconsistencies between the trust indenture and the Public Funds Investment Act, and so inconsistencies in the sense that one of the documents might authorize a certain investment and the other wouldn't. We want to make sure we go through that and get your input onto what investments we should authorize under the investment policy. In terms of the debt management guidelines, we mentioned the municipal advisory rules. We also want to discuss some of the impact of the Dodd-Frank legislation on how we deal with swap counterparties. There's a specific protocol that's being put in place throughout the country for discussions that occur between municipal issuers, who are often referred to as special entities, and swap counterparties, in terms of what products and what advice can be, or what exchanges, communications can occur between those parties. We want to discuss the possibility of considering an ongoing disclosure council. That's something we'll talk with David, but also would like to speak with you as well. In addition to all of these kind of technical and regulatory or guideline issues that we want to go through, we will also be kind of restarting the discussion of hedging rates going forward. We had I think Joe was kind enough to come in from PFM and give you a preview on some of the options related to hedging costs for our future bond issues, and that's an issue that we'd like to address again as we go forward after the April bond issue. And then the chair has already asked the question about refunding 2006 A bonds, and that also would be an area we would like to have some discussion or review on in the coming months. Now, Bill, is there anything you'd like to add with respect to the debt management guidelines? Are there issues that we're missing that maybe we should prioritize with respect to discussion with the board, further information?
I think it's a good start. Yeah, I think that as Chairman said, that it would be good to get some history on the changes and when they were made, the impact. And then I guess the new laws that govern Dodd-Frank that impact the changes we need to make also going forward. I think as a full board, I assume we can make this presentation again to the full board next week.
No.
Okay.
No.
Just
I think
we were just planning on what we were trying to do is set up kind of a 3-month process here. So having this pre-discussion to frame what we'd like to talk about, so that we can make sure to kind of put together the materials for you so that you can get them more than a day in advance of the discussion next month. And then we would see actually taking some type of action in, what would that put it, May. And at that point in time, we can do it whenever, but we were thinking that it would be more appropriate in May, to the extent we have a discussion with the full board, to go through the background on the committee discussion and process with them. But it's really, if you'd like us to, we can certainly do that. But
no, I concur. I think it's, okay. It's a good way. It's a good approach.
So we don't always have the luxury of that type of time when we're dealing with some of these decisions, but we thought these are large enough issues and important enough that we wanted to make sure we gave ourselves enough time to get you all what you need in order to help us make these decisions.
Our current investment policy, does it allow us to invest in municipal bonds or money market funds?
The investment policy allows it, but the Public Funds Investment Act does not. But I think the current policy reads, it ends with, to the extent it becomes allowable under the Public Funds Investment Act. It does specify municipal bonds, but it includes that caveat at the end. And we've tried occasionally to
seek legislative change.
Yeah.
So there's really four kind of different sets of either statutes or regulations that we have to look at in determining whether or not we can invest in a certain product. It's the Trust Indenture, the Toll Highway Act, the Public Funds Investment Act, and then our policy, our investment policy. And the investment policy in the past has been broader than the kind of small area that each of the three would allow us to do. Some of the indenture is a little broader than the Public Funds Investment Act, for example, on these issues. So the indenture would allow for an investment in municipal bonds. The investment policy does, but the Public Funds Investment Act doesn't, so we can't do that right now. So one of the questions we have, should we modify the policy to be more in conformance with the Public Funds Investment Act, or do we want to have the ability to invest in these products should the act change? That's one of the discussions we want to have.
And we should mention that the Public Funds Investment Act does allow municipalities to invest in municipal bonds. So
I asked that because we did that we put in the, our investment policy was old, and we saw, and that's sometimes you need to look at that, because obviously things change. Even after 2 years, you have to look at, you know, the type of revenue we're taking in, type of investments we need to be putting in, and we look at that. And I know a lot of municipalities too.
They've always been able to invest in municipal bonds, but agencies have not.
Now, when we're looking at the 2006, it's the issue there is they're callable, and are we now just looking at just the negative arbitrage that would occur if we refunded?
They're callable starting in July 1, 2016. And so the issue is the negative arbitrage between the date you would set up your refunding escrow to take them out and July 1, 2016. So you've got negative arbitrage in that period. So as that period gets shorter, the negative arbitrage goes away. But they're not callable yet. They're callable on July 1, 2016.
Is that negative arbitrage affected by any of where these proceeds go and where they're invested, or is it just strictly on the difference between the interest rates, between the refunding?
The difference between the rate on the refunding bond and what you invest in for that period up to July 1, 2016. And you're only allowed to invest in U.S. Treasuries in order for the bonds to become legally defeased. So obviously a two-year U.S. Treasury is still paying about 40 basis points maybe, and the bond yield will be closer maybe to 3%.
Yeah, so really none of this, even if we were able to go into the municipal market, it wouldn't affect that, because that refunding would only be done in
U.S. Treasuries, correct.
Required have treasuries to have a legally defeased escrow, which is important. If you want to be able to legally say those bonds are not an obligation or not off the tollway anymore.
I know that the MSRB has just so many changes with that EMMA requirement that it just seems like it's just being almost a hardship on everybody to comply with it. So I can see why we would really need some professional
to
make sure that you don't miss those deadlines.
So I have a question, comment. I guess comments first. As we put this presentation up online, can you also just include these issues on it so that people who aren't sure able to be here and are interested in what we're talking about will see the copy of this? And then the second is, we may not need this, but do the other trustees want those sections of the governing acts to be delivered to them? Like, what is the section of the Tollway Act that pertains to this? What's the section of the indenture that would be appropriate as background material for whole start this discussion?
what the changes that we're trying to make.
I would like to.